Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
We should get moving on. We have a lot to cover in Come Follow Me. This week in our Come Follow Me segment, we are going to be covering the second week of Isaiah. I'm sure Latter-day Saints love diving into Isaiah. We are all scripture nerds here, so we actually unironically love diving into Isaiah. The chapters we'll be covering specifically are Isaiah 13, Isaiah 14, Isaiah 24 through 30, and Isaiah 35. Now, these may not seem particularly noteworthy chapters on the surface, but there's actually some fun stuff in here. As I was just going through a little bit, we do have some of it that's quoted in the Book of Mormon. Chapters 13 and 14 of Isaiah are the last two Isaiah chapters that Nephi includes in his big Isaiah chunk. And also, we've got like a few, I don't know, like Latter-day Saintisms that we have kind of adopted into our vernacular and our doctrines that derive from the King James translation of Isaiah. So it'll be kind of fun to explore some of those. Things like the everlasting covenant and Lucifer falling from heaven and things like that. So we can talk all about that and contextualize what it would have meant to ancient Israelites and all that. But as far as situating us where we are in Isaiah, scholars tend to group Isaiah into two or three main chunks. You're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the first chunk is chapters 1 through 49, 47 maybe?
1 through 40.
1 through 40, I was way
39.
off. 39. 1 through 39, and then another chunk that goes up through like
55.
You better take this one.
So scholars break the book of Isaiah down into chapters 1 through 39, which they call First Isaiah, or when they're being pretentious, Proto-Isaiah. And then chapters 40 through 55, they attribute to or refer to as Second Isaiah, or again, if they're being pretentious, Deutero-Isaiah. And then the last portion, 56 through 66, is called Third Isaiah, or the pretentious title, Treato-Isaiah. And the reason for that is these aren't just neat divisions of the book that are convenient literarily. Scholars have basically argued that the second and third portions of Isaiah were actually written later than Isaiah, and by someone else who, for whatever reason, appended their prophecies or whatnot to the book of Isaiah and attributed them to him. And Second Isaiah is typically attributed to maybe the late 6th century, mid to late 6th century, I should say, B.C., during the Israelite exile. And then Third Isaiah is typically attributed to someone at post-exilic. I don't know whether 5th or 4th century exactly when the dating tends to be on that part. I'm actually a lot less interested in Third Isaiah, if I'm being completely honest. All of the scripture's important, though, you guys. I promise. It's just some of them interest me more. But all of that is still somewhat of an oversimplification. Since that theory first developed, source critics have been doing what source critics do, which is to continually splice and separate and break down the text and hypothesize that a whole bunch of text in First Isaiah was actually edited or amended or added by the Second and the Third Isaiahs, or that actually Third Isaiah is written by a whole bunch of different prophets and been spliced together by someone else, and some will say the same thing about Second Isaiah. There are some scholars out there who will attribute like 6 verses in Isaiah 8 to the actual original Isaiah, and that's it, or something like. I maybe am going a little more extreme, but it's actually
not by much.
Yeah, no,
there's some extreme positions that attribute very little to the actual 7th century, or I should say, like, you know, late 8th century, early 7th century prophet Isaiah.
Right.
It gets kind of crazy if you really get into it, but go figure, that's what source critics are wont to do. But yeah, broadly speaking, yeah, we're at the point where source critic wise, like, the division or the unity of Isaiah, it's an absolute thing you have to deal with, right?
Right.
And you have to account for stuff. It's kind of like accounting for evolution in some ways, just in terms of not in the sense that they both have been equally proven as valid, but in the sense that, like, it's become so dominant, this way of thinking now in the academy and the way biblical scholars approach Isaiah, that, like, you just invariably have to address it. And so everybody's going to have a theory. Everybody is going to have an approach one way or another. We're just kind of, and so hence, as you say, Neil, people have these crazy specific breakdowns, their own sort of way that they want to understand the authorship in unity or disunity of Isaiah, and it becomes a giant convoluted mess. I took a seminar on Isaiah in my coursework, and we devoted a lot of time. And yeah, it's not just the big, you know, 2 through 39 is proto-Isaiah and the rest. It's like, no, like, even within the chapters assigned to proto-Isaiah, you'll get people saying, oh, well, you know, well, for instance, Isaiah 13, for instance, people will say, oh, this is actually deutero-Isaiah, going back and, like, retroactively reworking over proto-Isaiah and yada yada.
Yeah.
It becomes quite convoluted.
And
it's a prominent paradigm.
What was that, Hales? Sorry.
I was saying, in any case, it's a prominent paradigm.
Yeah. And you know, I, as Latter-day Saints, I don't think we need to be totally opposed to the possibility that there is, you know, there's been some editing and some reworking of the text, and there's maybe some complex textual history here. But that also doesn't mean we need to, you know, adopt the most secular and critical of stances as to the composition of Isaiah and believe that virtually none of it came from an actual prophet living in the 8th to early 7th century BC, or that, or that the more prophetic texts of chapters 40 through 55, for instance, couldn't possibly have come from Isaiah himself or someone who maybe studied directly under Isaiah in the 7th century or something like that.
Do you find it matters much for your interpretation in your experience?
Depends on what you're interpreting, I guess.
Right. It depends on how you want to approach it. So if you're approaching it from a historical critical perspective, then yes, it absolutely does. But if you're approaching it from, let's say, a pastoral or devotional perspective, or as Christians, if we want to do, like, a Christological reading of it, then maybe not so
right.
much. So it just basically depends on which sets of questions you're wanting to address will, I think, determine which methodological tools you employ in your reading of the text.
Right. And so I think, you know, this is kind of just a be aware of these complexities and things like that. And if you're interested in those kinds of things, certainly we expect an interpreter audience will have some interest to some extent. And, you know, there is scholarship out there that you can pursue if you're interested. I think for the remainder of the show, we'll probably generally just be operating for simplicity's sake on the premise that this is all Isaiah, or we'll simply refer to the author as Isaiah for simplicity's sake.
Just refer to it as the text.
The text,
the text,
right.
Says this. No, that'll become tedious. Yeah, I think it's completely appropriate in the context of Come Follow Me to, we'll just assume Isaiah authorship for our purposes here.
So with that background of the authorship of Isaiah in mind, as far as where chapters 13, 14, 24 to 30 and 35 land in the narrative, so to speak, well, Isaiah doesn't really have necessarily a narrative. It's a collection of a lot of prophecies. There does seem to be some sort of overarching, coherent organization to these. They aren't necessarily all chronological, though. In some ways, they are. Isaiah is a very eclectic mix of things. And in some ways, getting the background to Isaiah is something we've already done, because we've already studied Kings and kind of a little bit Chronicles. Because Isaiah is a contemporary of King Hezekiah, and Isaiah is a contemporary of, like, the Assyrians at the time. And so a lot of Isaiah's prophecies are relating directly to some of the narratives happening in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. And so to get some background on Isaiah, it's helpful to have those stories in mind. And since we've already studied those in Come Follow Me, we do have some background there. In these chapters, in 13 and 14, it seems that right now these are part of like the oracles against the nations. So the first part of Isaiah is giving a lot of oracles or prophecies or foreboding future judgments on Judah. And then in this section, he's transitioning to condemning the surrounding nations because Judah's wicked. And so he's prophesying their destruction, but he also is prophesying the destruction of the surrounding areas around Jerusalem since they also have been quite wicked. And so in 13 and 14 specifically, we are targeting Assyria and Babylon. There are prophecies against Babylon, I think, is what's talked about in 13, and Assyria a little bit in 14 as well, talking about exactly what the Lord's going to do to them because of their wickedness, and that they, even though Israel was destroyed by them, they're also going to get their comeuppance, so to speak. And it goes into great detail of all of the vengeance that the Lord is going to exact in poetic form. Most of Isaiah is in poetry and in verse, though there is quite a bit of prose there too. So as Carrie Muelstein pointed out in his fair presentation, one of the best things we can do when studying Isaiah is just slow down and to take our time through it and not try to read it as a narrative, but try to read it as you would poetry, taking time to think on certain word choices and phrasing and why words are in a certain order. And in this case, I think having you supplementing your study with a different translation can be helpful, because the King James can be difficult to get through because there's so many archaic phrases, and Isaiah is using some confusing poetic phrases. And so as I've been trying to get through this material for today, I've been using the King James Version. It's got beautiful diction and poetry, and I do like that it often preserves Hebrew word order, but I've also been using the NET Bible, the NRSV, the LEB, things that provide a different perspective on some of these phrases because they can be a little hard to get through. And some of the words, you know, the King James versions are going to use different words for animals or different words for objects and peoples and cities, and so that can be really helpful. But why don't we dive on in and start with chapter 13. Does anyone have any thoughts off the bat on these first verses in 13? I mean, it starts off in verse 1, the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see.
I think it's maybe just worth pointing out, because a lot of people may be confused by that word burden. That is basically the Hebrew term for oracle or prophecy is also just the word for burden. And so in the KJV, it often gets translated as burden. Some modern translators will still retain that, but it really, more often you'll see in more modern translations, oracle, and they'll talk about this section as the oracle against the nations, this block of Isaiah where we just get prophecy after prophecy after prophecy, about different nations. So that would just be kind of just off the bat. I want to just point that out. If you're confused when you read the burden, this expression about burdens here, we're talking about prophecies or oracles made against these different nations.
So one question I have, if this is a prophecy about Babylon being destroyed in Isaiah, why is Nephi including it in the Book of Mormon? What value does he see in including this oracle against Babylon? If theoretically, it's kind of like, he's out of that world. He's, you know, in the Americas. What relevance does this prophecy against Babylon have for him? Any thoughts?
I think the scattering and gathering of Israel is going to be in a prominent theme for the Nephites as well, and a highly applicable one, possibly the highly applicable one from his perspective. So I think he has grounds to include it on that basis.
Yeah, definitely. So Nephi, as scholars like Joe Spencer and others have written to great effect, has this clear kind of typological, we call it likening, method for interpreting scripture. And the passages that he includes, he like explicitly says, I'm going to liken these unto the remnant of my seed and my own people, right? So you can kind of play this game where you switch out the characters of you know, Judeans and Babylonians with, like, you know, Nephites and Lamanites and Gentiles kind of situation. So that's another way that I think Nephi clearly sees the applicability and the imagery and the language as being as having relevance for his people, as Hales was saying. The the scattering and gathering of Israel is a big topic, obviously, in Isaiah. It's a big topic for Nephi. But also Nephi's own. So remember, Nephi has a vision where he sees like the long arc of history, where he sees what happens to his people and he sees, you know, what happens to them after his day and their restoration and so forth. That's in the first part of, or like the middle of First Nephi. And then the beginning of Second Nephi is when he says, I'm picking these prophecies because I've seen what's going to happen to my people, and these prophecies I can liken to them and what's going to happen to them, so that everybody reading this book can kind of get the point. This is his sort of way. In a sense, it's kind of like a midrash, a later Jewish form of exegesis. Not exactly, but there's sort of a flavor to that. So we can actually see, and I believe Joe Spencer has argued, and others have, that if we assume and if we accept the historicity of the Book of Mormon, then the way that Nephi, a Jew living in Judea, who flees shortly right before the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, this is one of the earliest like attested forms of interpretation of Isaiah coming from another Israelite, another Judean. So that may be significant for that as well.
So then if Nephi feels it appropriate to apply, to liken Isaiah to his own day and his own conception of gathering of Israel, is it appropriate for Latter-day Saints to then take these ancient prophecies of Isaiah and apply or liken them to things like the second coming and last days prophecies?
I think yes, very clearly it is. My only caveat or word of caution would be, some interpreters today like to take the prophecies of Isaiah or other biblical books, and they go in really weird places with them, where they try to do like sort of a one-for-one correlation, where like, oh, you know, this Babylonian king was this U.S. president during his second reign or whatever, and oh, you know, the 7 years of exile represents the 7 years of the American Revolution or whatever, right? Like, and I would caution against that way of likening, where you're trying to do like this sort of hyper-millenarian, you know, everything is a code or a cipher for something else, as opposed to just having a broad base. Like, look, we can see these cycles of history repeating. We can see what happens when powerful nations, in this case, Babylon, exalt themselves as the world superpower and they neglect God, or they are oppressive or tyrannical. We can see the downfall and things like that, right? So I think there's absolutely appropriate applications in that sense. But I would strongly advise against some of these, shall I say, charitably esoteric forms of modern Latter-day Saint midrash that are performed on the Book of Isaiah. I don't think we need to go in that direction. We can have a good, grounded, historical reading of the text for what was happening in Isaiah's day, and we can take the types and shadows of that and apply it to a Latter-day situation.
Yeah, I think particularly of in chapter 13, verse 7, it talks about how all hands shall be faint, every man's heart shall melt. And in verse 10, the stars of the heaven shall not give their light, the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And in verse 13, he talks about, I will shake the heavens, the earth shall move out of his place, and the wrath of the Lord of hosts in that day of his fierce anger. And so it talks about all these things. And I think lots of Latter-day Saints recognize those things as things we've talked about as signs of the second coming. And some of them find their origins here in Isaiah when it talks about like suns darkening, stars darkening, and what that means. And so clearly there is a very ancient context to what they thought those things meant for Babylon and for ancient Israel. But Latter-day Saints have also applied it to be a little bit typological for the second coming.
Well, and you know, you brought up Nephi, and he quotes this and he likens this to his own people. And Nephi, before he quotes this, he's had a vision where he sees what's going to happen to his own people right before the time of Christ, and he's actually going to see a lot of those things: sun darkening, the heavens and earth shaking and moving, and all of this destruction and the Lord's fierce anger and darkness and all of that will happen before Christ comes to the Nephites. And so, you know, what are some of the ways, why did Nephi maybe see this particular passage as relevant to his people? Well, perhaps because of what he saw in vision and how Isaiah's words seemed to echo that experience there.
Here's just one fun example where having another translation to kind of supplement your study can help. As I was studying in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 12, it says, I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the golden wedge of Ophir. And in the midst of all of this Babylonian prophecy of destruction, that kind of sounds like this like hopeful ray of sunshine that like man will be so precious, more precious than gold. Like it's like a hopeful thing or a nice thing. And that's technically like that is a way you could render that word as precious. It's the word yakar in Hebrew, but other translations will render it as I will make human beings more scarce than pure gold. People will be more scarce than the gold from Ophir. And other translations will have that thing as well. And that makes a little bit more sense in context of the rest of this chapter where it's talking about how I'm God and I'm going to destroy every building, every city, every person, every king, and the people will be more scarce than gold is the message there. And so when you're reading the King James Version, it can be a little bit harder to get that sense. Instead, it sounds like, oh, and people are going to be refined as gold, or they'll be like really nice as gold. No, they're going to be scarce as gold. And that's a very different message. So just, you know, one fun example of how a translation can help.
Yeah, that's a great example, Jasmine. I do want to give a plug for verses. Maybe plug's not the right word, a discussion of verses 17 through 22. So there's this phenomenon in biblical scholarship where it's called ex eventu prophecy, where scholars, they doubt whether something is an actual prophecy. They think it was a prophecy given after the fact of the prophecy and then sort of retrograded back onto the original event. In verses 22 through 17 through 22 in Isaiah 13, Isaiah predicts the destruction of Babylon at the hands of the Medes. So it says it's going to be like Sodom and Gomorrah, and the Medes will go in there and they will destroy it. And owls and jackals and these crazy creatures, these critters and creepy crawlers are going to live in the city. Well, the problem with this is that never happened to Babylon. If you go read the Cyrus Cylinder, according to his own account, Cyrus actually did not have to destroy the city because the people happily let him in when he overthrew the Babylonians. So actually, one of the ways, if we're going Mr. Critical Historical Method here, one way I think that it's a good way to tell that a prophecy is an actual bona fide prophecy is when it doesn't happen. Because the person uttered it, you know, anyways, I'm being a little cheeky here, but like this is a real way that scholars argue about how to date these texts. So I think there's something to be said for the fact that, as best we can tell, the sort of the surface level reading of the text or the plain reading seems to be a quote unquote failed prophecy of Isaiah in the sense that he seems to give these descriptions of the city that never actually happened. So what that might mean for this debate about the authorship and dating of the text, I'll leave open. But just to give everybody a flavor there of the kinds of questions that scholars grapple with when they work with the book of Isaiah. But in any case, if we want to follow along our typological reading, you know, we can talk about what's going to happen with all the destruction of the last days, with the second coming, and certainly what Nephi sees happens to his people. This language and imagery would have had immediate relevance and application for them.
And another additional possible perspective on how Babylon was not destroyed in that way is potentially, at least one commentator suggested maybe it's a reference to the destruction in 689 BC when Sennacherib destroyed Babylon. So this is much earlier before Isaiah had been prophesying. And so you can either say maybe Isaiah is retroactively referring to this earlier destruction of Babylon. Maybe he's predicting that Babylon will be destroyed and it doesn't come to pass. Or maybe it's kind of a little bit of both, where there's like a prophecy that's happening a little bit before and a prophecy that's happening a little bit afterwards. You know, there's kind of this conflation of time.
So what I would actually suggest here as one possible way to make sense of that is that you have an Isaiah who maybe does get some kind of prophetic premonition or insight as to what's going to be the fate of Babylon at the hands that they're ultimately going to get conquered by the Medes. And then he's going to take typologically what happened to Babylon, what the Assyrians did to Babylon, and use that as his template for describing the fate that they're going to have at the hands of the Medes. And then what ends up happening when the Medes come in is it doesn't actually map perfectly onto that prediction, but that's because the prediction itself was more of a typological application of a different historical event in the first place, that simply meant to convey the general idea that they'll be conquered by the Medes. And they were eventually conquered by the Medes. So
yeah, I'm open personally to that line of thinking on it. I just thought it'd be a good idea to mention these sorts of questions that come up here, and why paying attention closely to the text and knowing something of the historical background is really crucial. But yeah, once you get into the world of prophecy, which most secular biblical scholars don't want to do because they don't think it's real in the first place. But yeah, once you get into this prophetic worldview, then kind of all bets are off on how it's supposed to apply historically, since you get into the world of typology and things like that. Actually, Nephi's predictions do a lot of the same way, right? Notice that Nephi never actually names, and then Christopher Columbus in 1492 went on the oceans. He says,
right.
One among the Gentiles, among a mighty nation of the Gentiles, went forth on the many waters. Like, well, that could be anybody, right? Like, you could read it typologically. Like, the Gentile, quote-unquote, like the Spanish, European, British explorer, whoever, right,
right,
goes and undertakes this thing, as opposed to it being a specific historical person.
Right, and I do want to point out, while scholars will deal with prophecy in a variety of different ways, I think to some extent it needs to just kind of be recognized that the tools of doing history or even literary scholarship aren't necessarily what's best suited to assess prophecy, because prophecy is not by definition, by genre definition, it's not history, and it breaks the rules, the methodological rules of how history is supposed to work when you're doing it and studying it academically and things like that. And so, academics will often discount it generally because they kind of like it's in the rules of their methods of analysis to just say if it's accurately describing something, then it must have happened after that thing happened. Whereas, prophecy in and of itself is breaking those rules. It presents itself as breaking those rules. And to take it seriously, you need different kinds of tools than what you have as a historian, for instance.
And to your point, Stephen, in verse 20, it does say that, or in verse 19, it talks about how, when I destroy Babylon, it's going to be destroyed just as Sodom and Gomorrah were. No one will ever live there again, and no one will ever reside there again. And then it goes through like, no Bedouins will be there, no shepherds will be there, and just the wild dogs will be there, and the ostriches will live there. And so, I mean, you can also chalk this up to hyperbole and exaggeration and all that, but there is a sense that in this prophecy, at least, that this is like a very utter destruction, which we don't necessarily see happening with Babylon, which it's more of a diplomatic takeover by the Persians in some ways.
So you think there's a certain amount of prophetic going on here?
Save the dad jokes for your kids, Hayes. No, I'm just kidding. I loved it.
Well, should we go on to chapter 14? This is where we get the fall of Lucifer, the morning star.
And I actually wanted to say, before we dive into that aspect of it, I think actually 14 verse 1, if you want to talk about something that Nephi probably saw as relevant to him and his people in quoting this text. It talks about how, the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will yet choose Israel and will set them in their own land. And the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob. And in context with Isaiah, this is a kind of a prediction of Israel being reset in the Holy Land in Judea or Judah, and then having strangers or foreigners who will cleave to them. But for Nephi, if he's applying this to his own people, he's going to read that as this reception of their own promised land that they have received in somewhere in the Americas. And this is one of those little clues that you get in Nephi's selection of Isaiah that suggests that as they were settling the promised land, in whatever part of the America they were in, they were encountering other people. And and these Isaiah texts were one of the ways Nephi was trying to help them understand and integrate those people into them. And, you know, there are strangers, if you will, that are being joined with Lehi and his family, and they're becoming part of, they're cleaving to and thus becoming part of the house of Jacob through Lehi and his family and the covenant the Lord has made with them.
I think critically, this also indicates that the Gentiles are going to be brought in and joined with the house of Israel in some important ways. Though possibly not being entirely clear what those are.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And later on, it seems like they're in more of a service role than, than not.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's one of the ways I think we could cherry pick passages like that throughout all of the Nephi Isaiah, but that's not, we're studying these chapters of Isaiah here, but that's just one of the possible ways Nephi is trying to utilize and kind of draw meaning and likening out of these Isaiah passages here for his own people.
All right. Well, let's then jump into the verse about Lucifer in quotes. In chapter 14, it's verse 12 where we get what Latter-day Saints are probably familiar with. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground which didst weaken the nations? So we have these Isaiah chapters talking about the destruction of Babylon, and then it says, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you have fallen. What's going on here? Is this Satan? Is this Lucifer? Should we be looking at this in another way?
It seems like it's basically using the story of Lucifer's fall from heaven as a metaphor for the situation of Babylon, and basically saying you were so proud, you were so such a big deal, especially in your own sight, but you're going to be utterly crushed on account of basically putting itself in opposition to the Lord and his people.
So I think, Jasmine, in answer to your question, the answer is yes and no. No, this is not Satan in the sense that we typically think about it from a surface level contextual reading of the text. Isaiah is referring to the king of Babylon, and he makes that explicit in this chapter that that's who he's talking about. However, so that's the no part. The yes part is the fact that Isaiah is drawing on old and well-attested mythic archetypes that hearken to a cosmic battle in the divine council, where one of the gods presumptuously claims authority and rule over the council, and for that rebellion and for that presumption is cast out of the council and is disgraced in that way by losing their godly status, right? And scholars have gone bananas over this, comparing it with the Ugaritic sources, earlier Canaanite sources, widely attested parallels from Mesopotamia and Syria, Palestine. So I think we have a clearly a mythic archetype that Isaiah is sort of drawing from. That who's to say, from a Latter-day Saint perspective, this cannot also be tapping into our understanding of the fall of Lucifer as a divine figure from the divine council, which both the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham and the Pearl of Great Price make clear. But even if that's the case, which I believe it is, the immediate context is Isaiah is using this mythic archetype to apply it to the fall of the king of Babylon. And speaking, Anil, speaking about temporally, how does this work? Some scholars also say that he's actually referring to the death of Sargon II, the king of Assyria, who was killed in battle in 705 BC or somewhere thereabouts, who had his reportedly had his corpse desecrated. He didn't get a proper burial. Some say that he's taking that and that that then gets reapplied for the Babylonian king, right? So Isaiah is swimming in a world of sort of archetypes and typology. So yes, there's a mythic side to it that we can approach it to, but there's also the contextual, historically grounded side to it. So again, yes and no, it's referring to Lucifer, Satan, as we think of him. It gets more complicated than just a surface level reading would suggest.
Yeah, and in fact, I would even argue, Stephen kind of alluded to this, but I would argue that our what we have in our theology about Lucifer and the council everything that happened there. I would argue that that actually is a part of this mythic archetype. It's another variation of it. And when you think, I mean, it's actually pretty stunning that that's what Joseph Smith, if Joseph Smith made that up, right? It really is another manifestation of that very ancient mythic archetype, and we would, you know, believe it's ultimately the true. It's the actual. It's the true event of the based on true events part this archetype, if you will, which goes to what Hales was saying, that ultimately at the core of it, it is the events that happened in the premortal existence with Lucifer that through a series of mythology and stuff like that is ultimately what's being used to kind of critique the King of Babylon here.
And so what it sounds like we have is this Lucifer, son of the morning, is kind of talking to the King of Babylon and kind of drawing this metaphor that you are as this Lucifer, son of the morning, you're going to fall. You've tried to make yourself higher than the heavens and higher than God, and I'm going to cut you down for it and cut you off. But then there's also this mythic side of, you know, the origin of this metaphor, which we can approach as this member of the Council of the Gods who was cast out of heaven. And there's, if we're applying it to the ancient Israelites, that may be a reference to their to some of the Canaanite deities surrounding the area. I mean, the word here, in the scripture itself, in our English KJV, it says, you know, how art thou fallen, Lucifer, son of the morning, but Lucifer is not to be found in any manuscript of the Bible that I am aware of. Lucifer, I believe, is, what we find in the Latin Vulgate, right? That's where that word comes from.
Yes.
So what we see in the Hebrew is this word Halel. Or Hallel, Hallel, I think. Well, I don't have it in front of me. Halel, okay. Which is, you know, a reference to the morning star. And so you could say it's a symbol of what eventually becomes Lucifer, but it also could be a reference to a Canaanite deity. Halel, son of Shachar, is the other Hebrew word. So it says Halel ben Shachar, or the morning star, the son of the dawn, is kind of the more literal rendering of it. And in our KJV, it says Lucifer, the son of the morning. And so it's possibly a reference to a Canaanite deity of that similar role who, you know, tried to usurp this, the highest god of the heavens, El's power or something. And there was a conflict there. And then it's being applied to the King of Babylon, and we can also see into it our mythic belief about Lucifer being this son of God who was cast out from heaven. So there seems to be, this is a very multivalent sort of scripture with multiple applications, multiple meanings, and depending on what audience we're talking about and how you're looking at it. So pretty cool stuff. I mean, it doesn't make our interpretation any less true, but I think it does add value to see how ancient Israelites may have viewed this scripture and seen it as a reference to the King of Babylon. So any other thoughts on chapter 14?
I could just comment briefly, if you'd like, on the final verses of chapter 14, which is really kind of a separate oracle or burden, as it is said in the KJV, about in verses 28 through 32, we get this prophecy. It's a burden against, it's an oracle against Philistia, but we get this prophecy of a rod that smites, the rod that smote Philistia is broken, and referring to the dead king, presumably King Ahaz, but some have argued it's actually an Assyrian king that they're referring to. I think the imagery is actually very much royal Judean here. But you have this rod is broken, but from the broken rod, it says, out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice. That should actually probably be, that's a mythical creature that's like a chicken and a serpent mixed together, but more recent translations will usually render that more along the lines of a viper or an adder, a more ordinary snake. The word there is actually just a Hebrew word for snake. So shall come forth a viper, if you will, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. And here we get this imagery of basically successive generations of Israelite kings culminating in this fiery flying serpent. And there's different commentary on what this applies to. Like I said, some think it's actually referring to an Assyrian ruler, and there is some evidence that you've got like serpent battle standards and things like that coming from Assyria at the time. But you also have Judean seals and things like that that have flying seraphs on them that are associating that with royal imagery and iconography in Judea. And so arguably this is a Davidic king, a Judean king, and there's maybe kind of a messianic element to this prophecy. And that's interesting to me because the flying fiery seraph could be represented by the brazen serpent, which is also a seraph representing the fiery serpents of Numbers 21. And the brazen serpent, then, what do we have? What's Nephi do with the brazen serpent? He applies it to Christ. And he does it right after quoting, literally, it's in 2 Nephi 25. He does it right after quoting this passage. So just kind of a neat little potentially messianic prophecy that can potentially explain how Nephi's making the connection between the brazen serpent on the one hand and the Messiah, the future Davidic king, on the other.
All right, so that's chapter 14, and we have about a little less than 10 minutes left, so we have quite a few other chapters to cover. I would say we probably have enough time to cover one, maybe two more chapters. So if we wanted to do Isaiah 24, that's talking about the everlasting covenant and some second coming end of days stuff that Latter-day Saints tend to apply it to if you're reading the Latter-day Saint headings. Chapter 29 may be of interest to us because that's very Book of Mormon centric. I'm going to guess that's where we maybe want to jump to next. All right, let's jump to Isaiah 29. Because this is quoted extensively in 2 Nephi 27, and it has prophecies that Latter-day Saints and Nephi himself applied to the Nephites about a people speaking from the dust. So let's dive in. Verse 1 says, "Woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelt. Add ye year to year, let them kill sacrifices." Ariel being a reference to Jerusalem. So do we have any specific thoughts we'd like to jump in on how we can interpret this chapter in light of the Book of Mormon, but also staying true to the ancient Israelite context?
Yeah, I want to jump in real quick and say something about in verse 4. I'm going to read from the Jewish Publication Society Tanakh, because, again, the King James translation has some of these weird archaicism, like familiar spirit that people... So when people say, like, oh, a familiar spirit, well, the Book of Mormon, it'll have a familiar spirit. It'll sound familiar to you. Your spirit will resonate with it because it'll sound... I'm sorry to say that's a nice interpretation that grandma probably taught you growing up, but that's not what the Hebrew means. I'm sorry, but it's okay because it's even cooler what the Hebrew means. Okay, so I'm reading from the JPS Tanakh in verse 4. "You shall speak from lower than the ground. Your speech shall be humbler than the sod. Your speech shall sound like a ghost's from the ground. Your voice shall chirp from the sod." Verse 5, "And like fine dust shall be the multitude of your strangers, and like flying chaff the multitude of tyrants." So the imagery here is that Jerusalem has been obliterated with a divine nuclear bomb, right, by God. It's completely desolated, and everybody's shadow has been plastered on the walls from the nuclear fallout. And the only thing left that you're going to hear in this total desolation is the sound of little whispers and chirping coming from, like, haunting, like, you know, you hear whispers on the wind kind of thing. And so it's this very post-mortem, necromantic almost kind of, basically, like, you know, you're walking in a ghost town, you hear ghosts in the shadows. Like, that's what Isaiah says the situation is going to be like. That imagery, I actually think, is way more cooler and based than that we see in the Book of Mormon than our little traditional interpretation of it. Nephi is saying, when you get this book, which literally comes out of the ground from the hill Cumorah, right, when you get this book, it's going to sound like people, like the whispers of ghosts speaking to you out of the dust. And, like, I don't know. I think that's really an awesome image and metaphor to describe this record of these people that have like the inhabitants of Jerusalem, were obliterated by a divine nuclear bomb when their civilization was destroyed, and all that's left of them are these little whispers we get from this book. So I think by understanding it in that context, you see, okay, this is why Nephi is including this. Nephi knew what this meant, being a native Hebrew speaker. He knew what the imagery was, and that, to me at least, greatly heightens and appreciates my love for this imagery and how cool I think it is.
Absolutely.
It's like you said, it's super base, and it's like super epic in scale and in its artistic literary pull on you. But I think it's also multivalent because, I mean, in the immediate context, we're talking about the destruction of Babylon when Jerusalem gets when Jerusalem gets destroyed by the Babylonians. The Nephites kind of miss that destruction and they go off to America. So in one way, the dusts, the voices from the ground, the ghosts are the remnants of these Nephites speaking to ancient Israel. Like the only thing left of ancient Israel after Babylon's done with them are these like ghostly whispers from the Nephites, essentially, that will eventually come forward later. But also the destruction of the Nephites in the Americas is the exact same thing. They're going to be totally obliterated. And the only thing left are these whispers, these ghostly hauntings from the ground, which is the record of the Nephites. So super cool stuff either way. I think it's just really haunting, really is the only word for it. But it's powerful because not only is it haunting in an eerie way, it's haunting in an inspiring way that draws you to the ground, that draws you to the Nephites and their story, because it's a very compelling and tragic one.
We might also want to say something about starting in verse 11, which is the words of a sealed book, which will come unto you, right? Again, reading the JPS Tanakh, so that all prophecy has been to you like the words of a sealed document. If it is handed to one who can read, I think it's learned, right? Handed to one who's learned, but yeah, basically yeah. In Hebrew, one who is literate, and he is asked to read it, he will say, I cannot because it is sealed. And if the document is handed to one who cannot read it, he is asked to read it, he will say, I cannot read it. Of course, this is big for Latter-day Saints because reportedly, according to Martin Harris's version of events, this is what Charles Anthon sarcastically remarked when he was asked, where did this young farm boy get this book you have? Well, you know, he got it from an angel and it's a sealed book. I can't read a sealed book. And according to his 1832 history, Joseph Smith reports that when Martin Harris returned and told him this, that like kind of the alarm bells went off in Joseph Smith's mind, and he makes an explicit link with this with his own recovery of the Book of Mormon and that whole incident. I think again we've kind of beat the dead horse here, but typologically I think you can see where we have this application. I also think, truthfully, I think that Charles Anthon really did actually sarcastically say that. I think that he you know, he's this well educated learned dude. He would have known this reference, and when he hears you know, when he hears this guy saying, oh, it's a sealed book, he says, I can't read a sealed book. So I think Charles Anthon was sincerely sarcastic about it and like making fun of him. But that Martin Harris and Joseph Smith, when they hear this, they took it very seriously. Right. Yeah. And they immediately turn to Isaiah 29. So it's interesting to see how this all plays out and to see, again, these sort of what do you call them? Polyvalent, right? Or multivalent applications of this language.
Yeah. And Don Bradley actually makes the case for that kind of interpretation of the evidence in his book On the Lost 116 Pages. I just want to maybe give a plug. You can access this through the archive at Book of Mormon Central, but there was a paper by Robert Cloward in an old Farms publication in 1998, called Isaiah 29 and the Book of Mormon. And I think he does a really nice job of kind of working through what the relationship between Isaiah 29 and 2 Nephi 27 is, and this prophecy about the sealed book. And then also goes into the JST of Isaiah 29, where some of the text from 2 Nephi 29, 26, or 2 Nephi 26 and 27 is adopted, but not all of it. Clearly kind of indicating that even Joseph Smith understands there's an independent relationship to this text. But he makes the case that Isaiah 29 has its own context. Isaiah 27, which is not part of Nephi's big block quotation of Isaiah, 2 Nephi 27 is part of the section in chapters 25 through 30 that is said to be his own prophecy. And this is Nephi's own prophecy, and he makes the case that as part of that prophecy, Nephi appropriates language from Isaiah 29 to describe what he himself has witnessed prophetically of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, the carrying of the words to Anthon and so forth. And you know what's actually a fun fact many people may not realize? According to Joseph Smith's history, Martin Harris is present when they translate the passage that talks about the three witnesses, which is in 2 Nephi 27. And so Martin Harris would have actually been in the room. He would have been present when this text is translated, or at least at the Whitmer home, probably would have heard it read that night if he wasn't literally in the room when the translation took place. And it's kind of fun to think about, like, how is Martin feeling as he is literally hearing this text for the first time and recognizing, hey, that's me. I'm in this. That's me. And maybe that's a big part of why he's like, hey, I want to be one of the witnesses. I think I'm already in this text. I think I have a right to be one of those witnesses. Not to mention he had already been promised in DNC 5, which was given a couple months earlier, that he could be one of the witnesses. But I like to think about how it must have felt for Martin when he first hears this text, the day of, probably, and how it must have felt to be like, I actually did contribute to fulfilling prophecy here. But anyway, I think with that, we're pretty well wrapped up. Did anyone else want to contribute something to Isaiah 29?
No, I think we're good. I mean, this has been a really great discussion. I know we didn't capture everything we hoped to, but we hoped to at least contextualize a few passages that Latter-day Saints often encounter, but maybe don't always understand in their ancient context.
All right. Well, with that, I think there may be some dead air for a little bit because they don't have the newsreel running, but this has been the Interpreter Show. Once again, I'm Neil Rapley, joined here in studio by Jasmine Rapley and Stephen Smoot, and we've also appreciated the insights and comments from Hales Swift in New Mexico. Thank you, everyone, and have a good night.